The Cleveland Browns think they have their guy, and for once, he was not way down on the list of candidates. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score, 89.7's weekly look at sports. This week, we'll hear from a Columbus Dispatch writer about all the NFL teams shifting around.
And then we'll talk about the Columbus Blue Jackets and all the issues that are going on in Nationwide Arena. Folks, this team is bad right now.
And we'll also talk with a member of the Ohio State University Athletic Department about their degree completion program that pays tuition for athletes who return to school after turning pro. But first, for at least one day, Cleveland Brown fans were able to celebrate. The down-and-out franchise shocked many fans and even analysts by landing Hugh Jackson as their new head coach. The former Raiders head coach and Bengals offensive coordinator was seen as a hot commodity and eyed by more appealing teams like the New York Giants. Terry Pluto is a columnist for The Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com, and he joins us now. Thanks, Terry.
Hello, Steve.
You wrote that this is a good hire. The Browns got their guy.
Yeah, they did. To be very, very accurate. You know, Hugh Jackson was really desperate to get another chance to coach in the NFL. He did interview with the 49ers, but San Francisco really was not interested in hiring him. The nice thing is, I do know that if he was not number one on the Browns list, he definitely was on the top three. And usually the Browns are on list number 47 before they find their candidate. So this is a big improvement because they have a guy who coached one year in the NFL. He had an 8-8 record in Oakland, which is like having an 8-8 record in Cleveland. They almost should build a statue to you. And he's coached a long time for Cincinnati in the AFC North and had a lot of success there.
The Browns are moving toward a more analytical model, as people are calling it. They put some pretty wonky, numbers-driven guys in key positions. How does Hugh Jackson fit into that?
That's going to be the really interesting question. Yesterday, Jackson, of course, was saying this is a great idea. He's predicting in a few years a lot of other teams are going to be doing the same thing the Browns are. And I think every team does use these analytics to a certain extent. But I will say this, Cincinnati, where he came from, where he was the offensive coordinator, they're more old-line football. They don't do a ton of numbers. It's a lot more at the eye test. So the fascinating thing will be when you're sitting there at the number two pick in the draft and the number 32 pick in the draft like the Browns have, and Hugh's eyes are telling him one thing and the numbers are saying something else, how does owner Jimmy Haslam kind of resolve that conflict and make it work?
Jackson is an offensive guy. Some reports came out late yesterday saying that he would like to see the Browns move on from their troubled quarterback, Johnny Manziel. That would seem to really seal the deal, that Manziel probably will not be back in Cleveland next year.
I think any coach coming in here that says, gee, I want Johnny Manziel as my main quarterback, why don't you just drive your car right into a wall and just skip it right now? I mean, you have to come in there and say, I want to have the right to get rid of this guy. Now, that doesn't mean you cut him tomorrow. It could be you try to hang on to him for a while. There's no practices. Nothing's going on now. Maybe you could trade him to Dallas or something. But you make it very clear that any more dabbling in the pond of Johnny Manziel is a good way to drown yourself. So my guess is that's exactly what he said. And the truthful part of that, when it comes to the analytics, the Browns did $100,000 worth of analytic work on the quarterback draft of 2014, the draft that Manziel was in, and they were told not to take him.
Yeah, they told him to take Teddy Bridgewater.
Teddy Bridgewater, in fact, he wasn't even in the top three to take.
As you've mentioned, the Browns have the second pick in the upcoming draft. There aren't any quarterbacks, I don't think anyway, seen as elite prospects. Do you think they still go with a quarterback, a guy like Paxton Lynch out of Memphis or Jared Goff from California?
I really don't know at this point. That's where you're going to get the numbers guys are going to do one thing. You know, Hugh Jackson said yesterday at the press conference, I'm going to get to know that quarterback class very well. Hugh Jackson had tremendous success with Andy Dalton, the guy picked in the second round by the Bengals. And so they may find some guy that they like that they could get later in the draft and go with him, especially if it's a guy that Hugh thinks he could work with. And they could say, look, we'll kind of do what we did last year, start the season with Josh McCown. Hopefully he doesn't get hurt in the opening game, keep him upright and healthy for a while. They have Austin Davis, who's, you know, sort of a decent third string quarterback. You'd bring some kid in and work it that way. But you know, the hard part for me now for the Browns is, can they find a sort of solid football, they're going to call this guy the talent evaluator, who wants to work in the system? Because when you come into it, you kind of know that you're the third or fourth round draft pick here. Because the stats guys, Sashi Brown and Paul DePodesta, they were the guys hired first. And then they hired the coach. The coach is going to have some say in who's hired as a talent evaluator. So it's not like you're going to get a guy who's a traditional football general manager thinks he's going to come in here and have a lot of say in putting together the roster. So I'm just curious who this person's going to be to fill this position, because they need somebody to evaluate all these, you know, tackles in the fourth round and everything else.
Well, with all the questions around the Browns, we do know that they are the most interesting bad football team ever. Terry Pluto covers the Browns for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and Cleveland.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
A little over 20 years after Browns fans learned the Cleveland Browns were becoming the Baltimore Ravens, St. Louis Rams fans find themselves in an eerily similar situation.
And it is an odd twist of fate, seeing as though the Rams came to St. Louis just about a year after the Browns moved. The Rams had previously been in Los Angeles. They came to St. Louis. They were in St. Louis about 20 years, and now they're going back to L.A.
They are going to L.A. The Chargers might join them. There's a whole project where there could be two teams in L.A., and it looks like it's definitely going to be the Rams and probably going to be the Chargers.
That's right. And here for more now is Rob Aller from the Columbus Dispatch. Rob, after hearing all this, my first reaction is that I really just need a shower. This whole thing seems gross and pretty slimy.
You know, the fans are the biggest losers here. I was thinking, you know, wouldn't it be great if there really could be a boycott that played out, if the fans wouldn't show up and the owners would finally get theirs? That's not going to happen in the real world, but I'm with you. It's a messy business, and the owners just, it's a money grab. You know, the guy in St. Louis moving the team, he's from Missouri, but, you know, the stars of Hollywood, I guess, were too strong of an influence on him, not to mention the cash that's going to go in his pocket.
Well, the L.A. Rams were originally the L.A. Rams. They became St. Louis later on. Now they're going back home. It seems kind of unfair back in the day to L.A. fans. Then now it seems unfair to St. Louis fans. It doesn't seem really fair to anyone.
Well, let's go back even farther, because they're not technically going home. Their home was Cleveland. They were the Cleveland Rams until 1945, the year they actually won the NFL title, and they were the only team in history. To the very next year, they did not defend their title in the city where they won it. So they moved in 1946 to L.A., became the L.A. Rams there. So, you know, I guess if we're going to be fair about this, the team should go back to Cleveland. And you know what? I'm not sure anybody would complain about that with where the Browns are now. Just wipe out and bring in the new.
Hey, I'll take them. We'll welcome them right back to Cleveland. Let's get back to the owners a little bit here. They really do seem to want the best of both worlds. They spend so much time talking about how these teams are a real fabric of the community, how the players are so involved. You'll see pictures of these guys volunteering at soup kitchens and stuff. And then they really do just want to be able to pick up and move as soon as taxpayers won't fork over billions.
Exactly. You know, and this is the way it works. There's an emotional investment over the team and the fans. You know, it's not like total consumerism. You know, you go into a grocery store and you buy something and you don't like it, or the food's spoiled, and the consumer wins. But in this, it's not the case. So, you know, the fans, they lead with their hearts. And whether it's a stadium, you know, paying for a stadium or what have you, they keep showing up. They're still willing to pay because of that emotional investment in a team. You know, the owners hold the leverage. They threaten to leave. they threaten, you know, until they want what they want and they get it, typically. Look at Cleveland Browns. I mean, Cleveland Browns left. The fans were left holding the bag. And the same thing in St. Louis. You're right. It's greed. It's who has the power. The owners have it, and they wield it.
Yeah, I can tell you that as a 15-year-old Browns fan, when the team moved to Baltimore, it was horrifying. I mean, it really was like a family member died. And that sounds really silly. That sounds really melodramatic. But for a 15-year-old kid anyway, for an adult who couldn't process this logically, it was like losing a family member. It was that bad.
Yeah, and you were 15, and I'm sure that 35, 45, 55-year-olds had similar feelings. So, you know, again, until the fans stand up and there's some kind of revolution and not going to games, which isn't going to happen, or turning off the TV, which isn't going to happen, this is going to play out over and over and over.
For lack of a better term, how long has this practice of owners and franchises practically blackmailing the taxpayers to give them what they want? How long has that been going on? I was thinking about it, and it even happens at a smaller level. In Columbus, Nationwide Arena is totally footed by the city, and the Blue Jackets wouldn't be here if the city didn't provide this awesome arena for them to play on. How long has this been going on in sports?
Well, I think you can point to one guy. I mean, when the teams left, you know, when teams left Brooklyn and for L.A., that was a little different. But the guy I'm thinking of is Al Davis, who really held Oakland hostage when he went to L.A. with the Raiders. And then he did the same thing and lawsuits ensued and he went back to Oakland. So I think if you're looking for a ground zero point man on this, it would be Al Davis. Certainly owners held sway through the years going back farther, but it got very contentious and it got into almost a blackmail situation with Al Davis.
Rob Aller covers sports for the Columbus Dispatch. We've been talking about the Rams' move to Los Angeles and also the Chargers, what appears to be their pending move to Los Angeles as well. Rob, thanks again.
You're welcome.
So this will not come as a shock to many local Central Ohio hockey fans especially, but the Blue Jackets are still really, really bad.
They're bad, and the problem with them being bad this year is that everyone thought they were going to be good, not the way we thought they were going to be good 5 years ago, where there's an outside chance we can slip into a playoff spot, not the way we thought they were going to be good even last year, where they were picked to maybe win the Metropolitan Division when it was in a down year. They are bad in a way that we all thought. Media fans, that they were going to win the Metropolitan Division, and they are in dead last, the basement of the NHL.
That's right. 36 points, good enough for last place. And it really is an odd situation in Nationwide Arena, especially with the new coach, John Tortorella, brought in, kind of seen as a no-nonsense guy trying to get these players to live up to their potential. And it's worked somewhat. I guess he's a little better than his predecessor, Todd Richards. Aaron Portzline is on the phone now. Aaron, thanks for joining us. John Tortorella, 16-18-4 at the helm so far with the Blue Jackets. How would you say the John Tortorella experiment, if you will, has worked out so far?
Well, I mean, there's been times where the play has steadied, certainly from the start, but they still have been wildly inconsistent. I think when you hire a coach like John Tortorella, you expect to get a full examination, a full unearthing of all things within the dynamic of a team. And I think you've seen that. The leadership has been questioned. Some of the veteran players have been questioned. What you thought you knew about certain players, you're starting to rethink now. Younger players are getting more of an opportunity. And the way that he talks is starkly different from the way that management talked not long ago, where he refers to this as being part of a process now. This is the early stages, which is stunning if you think about the fact that management thought they were there. Management thought that this team was here and ready to win. And this coach is talking as though there's still major excavations of work to do behind the scenes. I think you're going to see sweeping changes, not just on the roster, but behind the scenes this summer in terms of, you know, strength and conditioning, training staff, how this team does things. in all manner, I think, with John Tortorella at the helm now, is going to be different.
I was about to ask if management is buying into the John Tortorella model, but then I thought back, yeah, they just traded Ryan Johansson for Seth Jones, a defenseman from Nashville. We talked about it a little bit last week, but how has Seth Jones been doing in his first week as a Blue Jacket?
Well, I think you have to say this quick before the evaluation of Jones. This was still management's trade of Johansson, and I don't think Tortorella was banging the drum to trade Johansson. I think he actually wanted a chance to work with this player. Management and the player never saw eye to eye. This trade's been coming for a long time. But I think Tortorella loves the trade. And if you see the last few games, I think you've recognized how Seth Jones's play has really begun to elevate. His playing time has been substantially higher than it was in Nashville. The role that he's playing in Columbus is bigger and is going to be bigger yet as he moves along here. Just a beautiful skater, really athletic player, a smart player. There's a poise about him. You can tell guys who grow up with professional athletes and their families. And for people who aren't aware, his father was NBA player, now NBA coach, Popeye Jones, basketball player. There's a presence about this kid. You hear people in Nashville talk about him as a potential future leader of the team, and he's got that kind of poise. I'm excited to see what this kid's ceiling is, because he's going to have an opportunity to grow here in Columbus that he didn't have in Nashville.
So Seth Jones, obviously making positive contributions to the Blue Jackets. How is Johansson's absence affected the team? How has it affected the locker room and just, you know, kind of the overall vibe of the team? What has the departure of Johansson done to that?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to me how you can take one player out and put one player in, and it changes the entire look of the team. And these are prominent players, first-pairing defenseman, number one center. Now I think you look at the Blue Jackets group of forwards and you scratch your head and wonder where's the jam coming from? Where's the offensive output going to come from? Who's going to be at the center of that? And as poorly as Johansson has played this year, he's one of those guys who's just good enough to put up points, even if he's not playing well, as silly as that sounds. Now you look at their group and you say, boy, they need a number one center, don't they? And they do, desperately. And those guys are as hard to find as number one defensemen are. So that's where they're at. I think they've got to strengthen their roster in terms of down the middle this summer to be competitive. You know, it's a pretty light team down the middle once you get past Brandon Dubinsky. William Carlson's a young player. Alexander Wenberg is a young player. Very slight players, too. They can be pushed around by larger players. And, you know, this is going to be an intriguing offseason. It's stunning to me if you think just 6 months ago, say a year ago, this team had Ryan Johansson, Brandon Dubinsky, Artem Anisimov, and Mark Letestu down the middle. And now it's gone. That was a strength. It was one of the deepest groups of centers in the league. And now it's gone the other way, where there's a huge vacuum there in the middle.
Steve mentioned John Tortorella's record as 16-18-4 so far. How much of that can be attributed to injuries? We talked a lot last season about man games lost, and Blue Jackets were running away with that stat, which is not a good thing. And now Sergei Bobrovsky and Curtis McIlhenny have been out for a period of time now, and Jonas Korpisalo and Anton Forsberg, two minor league hockey players, have been getting all the starts in goaltender for the Blue Jackets.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's five 21-year-olds, two 22-year-olds, and three 23-year-olds on the roster right now. So we're talking half of the playing roster each night is 23 years or younger. That is stunning. And a lot of it is injuries, but a lot of it is where the league is going. You know, they still had so many more injuries last year than they do this year, but they're still high. They're still among the leaders in the league. They're in the top third of the league in terms of losing games played to injuries. It's been an issue, but the play has been so poor, even when players are healthy and in the lineup. I cannot put any of where they're at based upon bad luck and injuries. It seemed a handy excuse last season, seemed a reasonable excuse at times last season. Not so this season. So many players have played so far below their average. So many things have been revealed about this team, how fragile this team was right from the start. And those things have been complicit in putting them where they're at, but I can't say the injuries have.
So is this a good thing for those young goaltenders, these 21, 22, 23-year-old goaltenders that are prospects in the league? They get a chance to play. Is that one of the silver linings in this situation?
Yeah, it is a silver lining. It depends on how things go for them. I think you can do damage to those guys if it goes the other way. If the play is so bad up here that it rattles them, and I haven't seen that. There's been a couple nights where you wonder if it's on the brink of that. But a game like Wednesday in Toronto when Korpisalo has 41 saves, if you're a 21-year-old goaltender, that's something you can really hang your hat on. That's a building block there. You've shown yourself you can do it. Now, it is the Leafs, I'll grant you, but it's still an NHL team. It's still 41 saves. It's still a win. You measure things differently, I think, when a season is lost like this. Experience is good, but bad experience is bad, and so far they've had mostly good experiences.
The Blue Jackets limping their way through the season with a lot of young players and a lot of injuries. They remain in last place in the NHL. Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Last week on the show, we talked about Ohio State football, and we emphasized on 9 guys that decided to leave Ohio State early, forego their last year of eligibility, leave school, and declare for the NFL draft. What the future may hold for those guys is most likely a chance to play in the NFL, but after that, much is still up in the air.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of big-time guys who thought they would be great in the NFL not pan out, and because they left early, they didn't have a college degree, at least not at that point that they went to the NFL. It turns out, I didn't know, maybe you knew, Thomas, but OSU will pay a guy or girl's tuition after they leave school and they come back. OSU will take care of their classes.
Yeah, it's called the Degree Completion Program, and it's for student athletes who do leave early for this, that, and the other, whether to go to the Olympics. In Katie Smith's case, she went to the WNBA, went on to the Olympics. Clark Kellogg declared for the NBA. Mike Doss left early for the NFL. And there's, of course, 9 guys leaving this year. They have an opportunity to come back if they meet a certain amount of requirements and finish their degree.
Yeah. John Macko heads up the program for Ohio State. He joins us in studio now. John, when did this program start?
The program started in 1994 here on campus.
1994, so a little over 20 years now. And how many athletes have gone through it?
We've got a lot have gone through the program. Some of the numbers right now, we've got 173 total graduates out of the degree completion program.
And that's for all sports, several different
for all sports, everything from baseball through football, basketball, wrestling, women's volleyball.
And a little bit more about the program. The program is designed for student athletes who decide to leave early from school and decide to go pro, or for whatever reason stop academically and leave the program. They come back later to get their Ohio State degree.
Correct. It's our commitment to them that we offer once we're recruiting student athletes to come back to Ohio State. A lot go for professional reasons, but some also have maybe personal issues and have to return to school. So our commitment is to help them graduate. Some of the parameters are it's your last 30 credits here on campus and a 2.0, and we fund full tuition for that. They do have to pay some incidental fees. And part of it is for the tuition credit, we'd like them to do some form of community service, whether it's Ronald McDonald House, whether it's at the hospitals, wherever they choose to volunteer for some of that work. There's a sliding scale based on their credits because they don't have to be full-time students.
And so some of these athletes left school because of personal reasons. Obviously, a lot of them left school because they're very talented athletes. And I'm sure it's kind of a who's who in Ohio State football and basketball history. Can you run through some of the people who've utilized this program?
Sure thing. Yeah. Out of those 173 graduates, 74 football. A who's who. Our first guy in the program was Clark Kellogg.
Oh, really?
Clark was our first guy. And another notable was Katie Smith, 3-time gold medalist in basketball. But anybody from Tessa Bonham, who's, an Olympic medalist in women's hockey, to Perry Carter, Mitch Clark in wrestling, Mike Doss, Ricky Dudley just graduated about 2 summers ago. Dennis Hobson, Mike Vrabel, Chris Gent.
Some great names I haven't thought about in years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's really rewarding because this is something that, you know, like I said, we committed to them, and it's kind of that unfinished business.
Well, some of those names you mentioned went on to work for the university. Mike Vrabel was a football coach. Chris Gent was a shooting coach for the basketball team. Yeah. Clark Kellogg sits on the board of trustees for Ohio State.
Correct. Yeah. Like I said, it's real rewarding. One of the stories that I remember was a guy named Dick Shafrath, and he was one of our oldest guys. And he came back, finished his degree, and which is really neat.
And you were telling me this story about an older gentleman who played football for Ohio State a long time ago, and he really had trouble adjusting to the new university, to what OSU looks like now.
Yeah, you know, over the years, you know, things have changed and we've moved to the electronic age. So dealing with, you know, online classes, Dropboxes for courses, the Karman website, once again, you have to kind of retrain people maybe in this computer age as to how to do that. So generally, if they've been out of school for, you know, over maybe 10 years or so, I'll encourage them to either take, you know, classes physically or maybe even take like a computer class to get them up to speed with what's going on in today's world.
When you recruit student athletes, you're like, we're committing to your degree. Do you guys see that as a huge pull for Ohio State and for the athletic program?
Yeah, because I think for me it's, you know, they are student athletes and, you know, they're students first. And when you meet these students at 17 and 18 years old, they may be thinking professional sports, you know, whether it's football, tennis, but it's all about getting the degree. And sometimes we, especially with football, I had football over 20 years here, and we kind of joke, you know, NFL stands for not for long, whereas you don't know how long your career may be. So we want you to get that piece of paper to graduate, to move on in life.
I know you work specifically for the athletic department. Has there been any discussion about broadening this university-wide? You know, I mean, I can imagine someone from the music department saying this isn't fair, that this wouldn't apply to, say, a violinist who leaves school early to play with the Cleveland Orchestra.
Sure. Because it is all unique, and it'd be great. I think it goes back to the funding of having the ability to do this, you know. But it is really neat what I see is these students go out into the community and give back. And once again, I had a guy came in. He worked at Ronald McDonald House last term, and he said that was such a rewarding experience for him because he had never done much community service.
And again, I can imagine some skeptics of this saying, this program shouldn't exist. You know, these people want to go pro. They're hedging their bets on being a successful athlete. They should have to pay their own tuition when they come back.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, it goes back to the recruiting piece and commitment piece that education is hopefully the number one reason why they're here is to get an education. And, you know, as I mentioned, through Gene Smith and this university to find the funds for this is just tremendous.
John Macko works in the OSU Athletic Department, and he heads up the Degree Completion Program, which pays tuition for student-athletes who return to Ohio State after becoming pro. John, thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can find an archive of episodes on the WOSU Public Media mobile app and also on iTunes.
You can give us a shout-out on Twitter, @AfterTheScore. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.